Limon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California and the feds both claim victory on net neutrality. We'll hear which side got the better deal. Okay, now some word association. When I say Coachella, you say music, right? Well, there's a farmer there who says...
They should be thinking about dates the same way they think about pineapples in Hawaii or potatoes in Idaho or oranges in Florida.
That more is all coming up on your daily afternoon date. Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for picking us this Wednesday afternoon. It's been another wild day in Washington, D.C. So just to keep you in the impeachment inquiry loop, earlier today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he indeed was listening in on that phone call President Trump had with his Ukrainian counterpart back in July when he asked him to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. This as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff announced they'd subpoena the White House for documents related to that phone call. Now, President Trump lashed out via Twitter, taking shots at Schiff and the Democratic Party, and then again during a televised press conference from the White House, standing alongside the president of Finland. Trump has called for Schiff to be looked at for treason, and Reuters' Jeff Mason asked the president if he considers anyone who opposes him treasonous.
No, I consider when they lie, when they stand before our great body in our great chamber, and they make up a story that's fiction, like Schiff did. He took that perfect conversation I had with the Ukrainian president, and he made it into a total lie. It was a total fabrication.
As always, we'll keep you updated with any breaking news on the impeachment inquiry. But we're going to start today's show here in California and on the internet. A court ruling over net neutrality has parties on both sides of the issue claiming victory. A D.C. Circuit Court ruled Tuesday that the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, has the right to wipe out net neutrality rules. But, and there's a big but that the FCC can't deny, they've can't prevent states from implementing rules of their own. California has been at odds with the department after passing a law last year that enshrined Obama-era rules that would force internet service providers to treat all web traffic equally. So, what does yesterday's ruling mean for internet users and tech companies here in California? We're going to get some answers from Ryan Single, Media and Strategy Fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Okay, now just to start, remind us exactly what net neutrality means and why California has been at odds with the feds over this.
Yeah, it's one of those terms that people kick around and sort of seems a little crazy, but I think there's a good simple definition, which is net neutrality is the principle that we get to choose what apps, services, websites we use, and not the companies that we pay to get online. That matters because we assume when we get online that we can do whatever we want to do, and that's the natural course of things, but that's only because we've always had an FCC protecting our right to do so.
Now, when it comes to California being at odds with the federal government, why has that been that way?
Yeah, in 2017, the FCC decided to get rid of all net neutrality protections, undoing 20 years of careful FCC work. This was a radical departure from what the FCC had done in the past. So seeing that there was a crisis for California, which is driven by the innovation economy, Senator Scott Wiener stepped in and introduced SB 822, which became law last September in a direct challenge to the federal government. The federal government took that as a challenge and filed lawsuit within hours of it being signed into law by then Governor Jerry Brown.
And now we are where we are right now. And as I mentioned, the circuit court ruling has both the FCC and net neutrality proponents claiming victory. A few key parts to their ruling. So break it down for us. So what did it say?
Yeah, it was an odd ruling. So essentially, when the FCC decided to get rid of net neutrality rules, the way it did that was by basically saying the companies that we pay to get online, like AT&T and Comcast, that the FCC had no authority over them whatsoever anymore. So this court decision essentially said, okay, you're an expert agency. We will give you deference to your opinion, but we're also going to make you live with the consequences of that decision. So in the case of state preemption, the court said, well, if you don't have any power over AT&T or Comcast, you don't have the power to tell states they can't do something.
We're talking net neutrality with Ryan Single, Media and Strategy Fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. All right, so the court's ruling definitely a mixed bag, but it doesn't mean that California can enforce its laws yet. Why would they not be able to?
Yeah, in a bit of an odd situation. Right after the law was passed, the DOJ sued, and it was on a fast track. So, you know, California's Attorney General's office has a lot of lawsuits going against the federal government. So they agreed that the Attorney General would not enforce the law until the courts had ruled and all appeals had played out. So now we're waiting to see whether or not the advocates that sued over the repeal appeal this decision and whether the FCC appeals. If neither do, then California can start enforcing its law and we will see a court showdown directly over SB 822 shortly.
You mentioned how we're going to wait on appeals. Where does it go from here? How much time will the FCC have to file an appeal?
Yeah, well, it's going to see, we'll see a decision on that somewhere in the next 30 to 60 days. And, you know, they could appeal either for what's called an en banc rehearing. So 10 judges from the DC Circuit Court rather than the three that heard this argument, or they could go to the Supreme Court directly and say, hey, we want a rehearing on this particular issue. We won't know that for a little bit. Both sides could appeal. We'll also, on the political side, I assume we'll see more pressure on Congress to act. Earlier this year, the House of Representatives passed a bill called the Save the Internet Act, which would restore the 2015 protections. When that got sent over to the Senate, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had the nice quote, net neutrality is dead on arrival in the Senate. So whether his recalcitrance holds, I don't know. But, you know, we have a political battle. I assume this will be part of the 2020 elections as well.
Now, California, home to Silicon Valley, and this seems like it would be something that the big tech companies would be watching very closely. Turns out, though, they might not be that interested in it right now after all. Why wouldn't they be?
For the large platforms like Google and Facebook, right now, antitrust looks more like a, you know, as Mark Zuckerberg said to employees recently, it's an existential threat. So that may be consuming a lot more of their time. That said, you know, Twitter has been a big backer of net neutrality recently. Google and Facebook are supporters, though not as strong as they've been in the past. And it is incredibly popular among tech workers and investors and startups because net neutrality is really the tool of the underdog. It is the thing that allows a small company to compete with the large companies. They don't have to pay for fast lanes. They don't have to literally pay AT&T simply so their website works for AT&T customers. I started a company about 7 years ago, competed with companies that had over 1,000 times more funding than I did, and was able to do it on a level playing field thanks to net neutrality.
All right, now one more thing, Ryan. Just like I do with my laptop, I put it to sleep to save the energy on it. What's it going to take to put discussions over net neutrality to bed, just so it's over with and we don't have to think about it anymore?
I think it's going to have to eventually be politicians listening to the American people. It's only in Washington, D.C. that net neutrality is a partisan issue. If you look at the polling, over 80% of Americans think that their ISPs shouldn't interfere with what they do online. You know, there was a crushing number of public comments, you know, opposing this repeal. So I think eventually we'll get Congress to move to put in strong protections. And then once they're there, we're just all going to expect that going on for forever. Like, we'll have the internet with solid rules to operate the way we have sort of had it, that we get to choose what apps we use. We get to choose whether, you know, we use Skype or Vonage or Apple iMessage, not the companies that we pay to get online.
Ryan Singel is Media and Strategy Fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, now to the environment. In the face of climate change, scientists are searching for pockets of ecological resistance, places in our environment that seem to be warming less quickly than others. These spots are called climate refugia, and the hope is that as the Earth continues to get hotter, they could serve as safe havens for plants and animals. KQED reporter Lauren Sommer has this story from the Devil's Postpile National Monument.
It was pretty cold the morning I met Deanna Doolin, which was weird because it was the middle of a summer heat wave.
You definitely need your winter coat with you.
Well, see, when I came out this morning, I had the sweater and the vest.
Doolin is superintendent of Devil's Postpile National Monument. It's a steep mountain valley just outside of Mammoth Lakes in the Sierra Nevada. Enjoying the cold are about 100 violet-green swallows feasting on bugs hatching out of the river in this meadow.
That's really cool. on their rumps are the most dazzling emerald green and kind of amethyst purples.
This valley stays colder than the 10,000-foot peaks around us. Doolin first noticed that when she started working here almost 20 years ago.
That's the opposite of what you expect. It was even colder than I ever anticipated it would be.
So she started working with scientists who installed dozens of temperature sensors. And they figured out that something special is happening here. It's called cold air pooling. Basically, a giant mass of cool air just sits here, thanks to the valley's shape.
These high walls on the east and west side actually limit the amount of sun.
The mountains above cast a huge shadow on us, preventing the air from heating up in the morning. And that air is trapped here because the valley has a very narrow opening at one end where the granite walls come together.
And so essentially that cold air bottlenecks up into this meadow and makes it even cooler.
As much as 18 degrees cooler in the morning compared to land a few thousand feet above it. Doolin says that means this valley could be buffered, shielded from a warming climate. It'll still be affected, but even a few degrees of difference could help the ecosystem survive.
Doesn't mean it will survive forever, but it's giving us time to look at additional conservation strategies.
Doolin says the Park Service is already looking at giving this valley extra protection, like keeping out invasive species or making sure forests aren't overgrown and prone to fires.
There's no easy answers, but it's the challenge that we've been called to do, and it's part of working for the National Park Service.
Devil's Postpile isn't the only place the Park Service is trying this. In Maine's Acadia National Park, research ecologist Tony Lynn Morelli just mapped climate refugia for 30 different plants and animals there. She's based with the U.S. Geological Survey at the Northeast Climate Science Center in Massachusetts.
There's urgency. There's urgency in identifying these places so that we can protect them.
But the big question is, how long can these places endure, given how fast the climate is changing?
In one sense, this is just buying time for us as a society to come up with better solutions and stop climate change.
Morelli sees these climate refugia as small pockets of resistance, holding out in a fast-changing world. I'm Lauren Sommer, KQED News.
All right, now let's all take a deep breath and think for a minute about our air. Today is the second annual California Clean Air Day, when the state's residents are encouraged to look at their behavior and take action to reduce their impact on air pollution. Maybe you're driving an electric car right now, or maybe you've decided to forego driving for the day and take public transit. Anything that helps reduce the contaminants that we put into the air counts. So maybe it's just eating all the food in your fridge instead of throwing so much of it in the trash to be hauled away and landfilled. Or maybe planting a garden to grow some of your own food. This morning I walked out, there were two little red tomatoes. I just planted those not that long ago. Made my whole day, brighten it all up. Whatever it is, the Coalition for Clean Air putting on today's event is asking that we all pledge to do something, even if it's small. So far, 1 million actions have been pledged. Is one of them yours? Tell us what you are doing for Clean Air Day. Find us on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter at take2.org. All right, millennials take a lot of abuse from Gen Xers and baby boomers. Some of it is all in good fun, but to be fair, most of it ain't. Self-entitled, broke, but with expensive taste. We've all heard the negative assumptions about millennials, but how about caring and giving? Coming up, why all of us older generation folk might be relying on millennials' kindness to keep us happy, healthy, and alive in our waning years. Find out how when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A federal judge this week dealt a blow to Asian Americans who tried to argue that Harvard University's admissions process discriminated against them. The group behind the effort, Students for Fair Admission, said Asian Americans were held to a higher standard, calling it a penalty. The judge did not agree and said there's no racial animus in the way Harvard admits its students. However, This isn't the first time that Asians have taken aim at college admissions policies. In recent years, they've become one of the most visible groups against anything resembling affirmative action in the application process. Now, to walk us through this latest lawsuit and the future of cases just like it, we have Janelle Wong, professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland. She's also the author of several books, including Immigrants, Evangelicals, and Politics in an Era of Demographic Change. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why has this issue of college admissions galvanized some Asian Americans?
Well, I think that for some Asian Americans, there is misinformation that using race in college admissions hurts their chances of getting in because they are already a large part of the college population. And they feel that as colleges and universities seek diversity, they will penalize Asian Americans for just being Asian American.
Now, how have schools justified any consideration of race?
The way that colleges justify consideration of race is really to say that a diverse environment is part of their mission. And so they are allowed to consider race as one of many factors and never the only factor. Students are evaluated as multifaceted individuals. And I think this is really important for Asian Americans because then Asian Americans are not reduced simply to a test score. I know in my own applications, I emphasize my Chinese American identity. Mm-hmm. And that was a really important part of who I was and who I am today. And so I think students should be allowed to have those kinds of experiences recognized by admissions officers.
We're talking to Janelle Wong, professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, also the author of several books, including Immigrants, Evangelicals, and Politics in an Era of Demographic Change. Now, in 2014, there was a move to end a ban on affirmative action in California schools. That effort died in part because Asian American activists throughout the state, they lobbied state lawmakers because they believed their children would be hurt. What does that tell you, though, Janelle, about the lobbying power of Asians on this issue?
Well, I think it's really important to both recognize that some Asian Americans do care about this issue and that they have a lot of kind of firepower when it comes to lobbying, but they are not speaking for the entire Asian American community. So in public opinion research of Asian Americans that's done in multiple languages, we see over and over and over again that Asian Americans are more likely to support than oppose affirmative action policies. And so I think it's really important to separate grassroots activists who might be driven even by misinformation. I think in that case, there was confusion. A lot of those activists thought there would be hard quotas put in place, which have been illegal since the 1970s, from the vast majority of Asian Americans, many of whom actually support the use of race in admissions.
Now, the last time affirmative action was challenged in a high-profile case, that was before the Supreme Court in 2016, and there a white student argued against the admissions policy at the University of Texas. Now, she lost that case, but she and her lawyer formed the organization that represented the Asian Americans in this latest lawsuit against Harvard University. Janelle, is that how we might see this issue play out in coming years, Asian Americans being put forward as the face against affirmative action in admissions?
Yeah, I think that that is what made this case really, really critical, is that Ed Blum, conservative activist who has long been taking aim, as you say, at affirmative action and race-conscious admissions, he has found it quite effective to put Asian Americans forward in these cases because it is confusing to the public, and it also, I think the charge that there is anti-Asian discrimination in college admissions, while it has not been shown, and while this case shows that Harvard did not intentionally discriminate against Asian Americans, that it makes it easier for him to push forward a conservative agenda and not be called a white supremacist.
So for this case in Harvard, when it comes to the organization Students for Fair Admissions, sounds like you think there are broader political implications involved here, not just necessarily affirmative action.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this case highlights the potential role that some non-white conservative activists, especially Asian Americans, might have in future kinds of political conflicts. Again, they're not representing all Asian Americans, but I have seen Asian Americans who have challenged, let's say, sanctuary cities in my home state of Maryland, or deferred action for childhood arrivals, or a range of different kinds of progressive policies. And so I think there is a kind of new role for this group in racial politics going forward in the U.S.
Now, this most recent case was in a federal court. What are the chances it could rise to maybe the Supreme Court?
I think that most of us who are involved in this case believe that it will go to the Supreme Court. Edward Blum has made it very clear that his intention all along has been to move this case, regardless of the decision yesterday, to the Supreme Court, because he really wants to and has dedicated his life to ending the use of race in admissions. So I fully expect it to be appealed. He has said he will appeal. And it's really, I think, up to the Supreme Court to see whether or not they will take it up.
Janelle Wong, professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland and author of several books, including Immigrants, Evangelicals, and Politics in an Era of Demographic Change. Janelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Jay.
All right, now to a different kind of lawsuit. Three Republican voters are suing California's Democratic Secretary of State for failing to ensure that only eligible voters are registered to vote. The California Report's Marisa Lagos has the story.
The lawsuit charges that Secretary of State Alex Padilla is violating federal law by not verifying the citizenship of people who are automatically placed on the voter rolls by the DMV. The suit is being brought by attorney Harmeet Dhillon, a Republican National Committee woman who also sued over a recent state law requiring presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to appear on the primary ballot.
California refuses to use the data in its possession to determine citizenship eligibility, which is a prerequisite to vote in all federal elections. So we believe that this failure violates the National Voter Registration Act.
Padilla says his office follows the law and called the suit an attempt by the GOP to bring their, quote, voter suppression playbook to California. I'm Marisa Lagos.
All right, moving on. The so-called silver tsunami of aging baby boomers has created an ever-growing need for caregivers. In many cases, that falls on the kids in the family. And as KPCC's Michelle Faust-Raghavan reports, that means millennials make up an increasingly large portion of the people caring for older family members.
Lionel Mares adjusts his mom's hospital bed.
And I would like make sure that she's comfortable, que sea a gusto.
The 33-year-old part-time graduate student says he's always been very close to his mom.
I get massage her head, her neck, her legs, and her arms.
Mares' mother, Angelica, has high blood pressure and chronic kidney disease. A serious infection has kept her in a Mission Hills hospital since August. He says her health problems started getting serious back in 2013.
Because my mom had a heart attack. And ever since, she needed dialysis, and I needed to take care of her because she could no longer drive and be independent on her own.
Mares and his aunt share the many responsibilities involved in taking care of his mom.
And I will assist my mom getting dressed, brushing her teeth, transferring from the bed to the walker.
He says the work takes a toll.
It becomes mentally exhausting and overwhelming.
Mares is part of a growing population of millennials who take care of sick family members. The AARP says of America's 40 million family caregivers, one in four is an adult under 40. The nonprofit says these caregivers need help, and it's available.
Es confuso esto en la comunidad. Por eso hacemos esto para la comunidad, para que se den cuenta qué es.
About a half dozen family caregivers sit around a conference table, learning how to best take care of their parents with Alzheimer's. Angie Moran is leading the training for Alzheimer's Los Angeles.
They're not alone, ultimately. That's what I want them to take out of this training.
And she says she wants her clients to avoid something all too common for caregivers.
Burnout. We want to avoid caregiver burnout.
Alzheimer's LA has care coordinators like Moran, who link families to support groups and respite care. That's temporary care for a loved one if you need a break.
There are plenty of organizations like ours that have these free community services, even your healthcare plans. And if not, then, you know, ask doctor, ask whoever for them to refer you to, but you need to be your own advocate.
Lionel Mares says he's been meaning to find a caregiver support group for months, but he hasn't found the time. He says he also hasn't had time for himself.
If she wasn't severely sick, I'll be able to focus on my other priorities.
He'd like to be in grad school full-time and earn a master's in public administration. Mares says he also doesn't have time to hang out with friends or to travel.
Many people that I know have gone camping to, you know, Sequoia National Park or Kings Valley or gone to Hawaii, and I would like to do those things, you know, have some real fun.
Still, Mares says what he does for his mom is worth it.
Because when my mom is happy, I'm happy. I feel relaxed. I feel better.
His experience of caregiving for his mom has inspired him to pursue a career as a patient advocate so he can help other caregivers who are struggling. Covering Health, I'm Michelle Faust-Raghavan.
All right, I gotta admit, I'm really looking forward to seeing Joker with Joaquin Phoenix. Technically a comic book movie, it's about a villain, not supposed to be for little kids' eyes. So for parents, if you took your little ones to see Spider-Man over the summer, Joker is a hard 180 turn in tone. And that's one of the reasons why the film has had a controversial landing in its upcoming opening weekend runway. Coming up, unwrapping Joker's many layers of complicated. That's next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez, as you just heard on Hetty's newscast, opera star Placido Domingo has resigned from his post as general director of the Los Angeles Opera following allegations of sexual harassment. We're going to have more on that sudden announcement on The Frame with John Horn at 3:30 today, so stay tuned. In other arts news, the highly anticipated Joker film is set to be released this Friday, but there are questions about whether it can overcome all the controversy around its violent nature and succeed at the box office. Plus, we're also going to take a closer look at the digital de-aging process being used in two major films. Let's go on the lot.
God, am I with you?
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our guide every single Wednesday. Hello, Rebecca.
Hiya.
All right, Joker. I've been pinching myself for so long, Rebecca. I can't wait to see Joker. It hits theaters this Friday.
I used to think that my life was a tragedy. But now I realize it's a comedy.
It's a new imagining of the iconic Batman's villain's origin story starring Joaquin Phoenix, and it's been mired in controversy ahead of its release. Why, Rebecca?
Well, when the film premiered at the Venice Film Festival, it got some wonderful reviews, but also some reviews from critics who pointed out that Phoenix's very realistic portrayal of a mentally ill loner with a gun had some sort of uncomfortable parallels in our modern American society. There were also some victims, family members of victims of a shooting that took place in Aurora, Colorado in 2012 during a screening of The Dark Knight, who have expressed their reservations about the film and about some of the marketing for the film.
And my understanding is that in those particular theaters up there in Colorado, it's not going to show. The Joker, they're just not going to play the movie there.
There's one theater, the theater where the shooting took place, will not be playing the movie. Yeah, that's correct.
Now, any projections as to how this negative attention might affect the film's box office performance?
Well, it's interesting. It's tracking to open at more than $80 million domestically, which would set an October box office record. And it does not appear, at least as of the tracking numbers that we're seeing in the last few days, that the sort of negative chatter around the movie and around potential safety issues is deterring a lot of the people who are interested in seeing it.
And it seems like this is something that the filmmakers might have anticipated. How did the studio market this film?
Well, from the get-go, Warner Brothers was interested in making sure audiences knew this was not one of its typical DC films. You know, this is not meant to be for the same audience who goes to Wonder Woman or Shazam. It's rated R. It is, as I said, is very realistic portrayal of this character. So Warner Brothers, one of the things that they did was deciding to have it open in the fall rather than in the summer or during the, you know, winter holidays, which are typically family going movie periods. They also tailored their marketing to be really focused on Joaquin Phoenix's performance rather than, say, some action set pieces, which there are in the film. And they have also deliberately not had any consumer products associated with this movie. So you're not going to go to Target and see Joker toys.
Now, you mentioned the controversy about the films of violence. How has the studio handled those complaints?
Well, they issued a statement in response to the Aurora victims, sort of expressing sympathy for those families, pointing out that their parent company, AT&T, had called on Congress to take some efforts in the gun control debate. But they've also attempted to make clear that the movie itself is not endorse or condone violence, that the Joker character is not intended to be a hero.
Now, meanwhile, director Todd Phillips, best known for comedies such as the Hangover trilogy and Old School, is facing some heat for statements he made about, quote, woke culture and comedy. What did Todd Phillips say?
Well, this was in an interview with Vanity Fair for their cover story on Joaquin Phoenix. Phillips mentioned that he had stepped away from doing comedies because it was so hard to make something funny in a contemporary, as you said, woke culture. The comment has gotten a lot of derision online, including from some people in Hollywood. I mean, one person who tweeted about it was director Taika Waititi, who has a movie also in the awards race this year, Jojo Rabbit. And he just tweeted, lol, he funny, regarding Phillips's comment. Another person who mentioned something about this was Lulu Wang, the director of The Farewell. There are plenty of people who are managing to make funny movies. They are people of different backgrounds than Todd Phillips, but they're not sort of hamstrung by questions about identity in the way that he seems to feel that he is.
All right, let's move on now to a visual effect that's having a bit of a moment right now. And I'm talking about the de-aging technology making an appearance in a big way in the upcoming films The Irishman and Gemini Man. Rebecca, why is this visual effect important to these two particular films?
Well, in Irishman, Martin Scorsese is using a digital technique for flashback scenes involving Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci. De Niro appears as four different ages in the film, two of which relied on digital effects to sort of remove wrinkles and spots. In Gemini Man, director Ang Lee is using a different digital technique on Will Smith, who plays an aging hitman fighting a younger clone of himself.
Now, the trouble with something like this is it could be distracting. I mean, for the most part, I assume the audience is familiar with what these actors used to look like when they were young, so they may notice flaws or maybe inaccuracies. You've seen both of these movies, Gemini Man and The Irishman, Rebecca. Did you find the de-aging effects maybe distracting?
Well, one of the issues critics have pointed out in the largely very positive reviews for The Irishman is that even though De Niro's face looks young, his body, the way he moves and stands, still looks like a 70-something-year-old man. So that tended to take some people out of the experience. And it really raises the question of, because you can do something, should you? You know, one thing I was struck by in watching the movie, which I really liked, was that a key role in De Niro's career was being cast as young Marlon Brando in Godfather 2. Could you not have made this movie with a talented young actor playing a 30-something De Niro? You know, is it enhanced by using these techniques?
One less salary, though, right? You get De Niro's salary, and then you have to get that young actor's salary. So I would imagine.
Trust me, young actor is a lot cheaper than the visual effects budget on The Irishman.
Now, different digital effects houses were used for these films. It was Industrial Light and Magic in The Irishman, and Weta Digital in Gemini Man. Is there a big difference between these two?
On Irishman, ILM used a rig called nicknamed the three-headed monster, which is basically one camera in the middle and two what they call witness cameras on the side. ILM designed it specifically for the film because De Niro didn't want to have to wear a helmet and a bunch of dots on his head, which, you know, if you've seen pictures of how some visual effects work using actors is achieved, that's what they have to go through. It's sort of artificial for many actors. On Gemini Man, Weta created a wholly digital character. One advantage I think that Gemini has purely on the visual effects standpoint is that 51-year-old Will Smith does not actually look that different from 25-year-old Will Smith. I mean, I will definitely say I'll have what he's having.
I'm all for technology, Rebecca Keegan. I love technology. Bring me more technology in what I watch.
Great. Next week, I want to do this conversation with the digital A. Martinez.
Or we could do the younger version of ourselves, both 20-year-old versions
okay,
of us.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the Endeavor Group and how it backed off plans to become the first Hollywood agency to go public. What happened with them?
Well, ahead of the planned IPO last week, Endeavor was being forced to lower their share price. They thought they were going to open at $30 to $32 a share. Then they were down to $26 to $27 a share. It became clear that they might open and drop even lower than that. So the company pulled the plug in a really kind of dramatic last-minute fashion. It was the night before they were to launch their IPO. Literally, executives from Endeavor were driving to the New York Stock Exchange to unfurl a banner for their company, according to reporting by my colleague Kim Masters. So quite a reversal of their plans.
Now, this comes on the heels of the agency's fight with the Writers Guild of America. How big of a blow is this for Endeavor?
Well, Endeavor's downplayed the role the Writers Guild has played in their attempts to go public, although the Guild was quick to issue a statement saying the retreat showed that, quote, investors didn't buy the company's conflicted business practices. It's certainly a big blow for Endeavor, not just for Endeavor, for other agencies that were hoping to go public, among them CAA and UTA.
So what happens next year?
Endeavor saying they've just hit pause on the process. They're going to wait until market conditions are better. In the short term, it means that expansion plans that they had are trimmed at the very least. They were also counting on this IPO to help them pay down some debt, and so they were going to have to find another way to do that.
All right, Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, another quick culture note. Los Angeles has opened a unique new library, one devoted to homicides. The LAPD and the FBI unveiled it earlier today at the police department's training center in Westchester. Materials from solved and unsolved crimes will be stored at the library for detectives and researchers to study. The effort began when the two agencies started a pilot program to digitize the paper homicide records from cold cases. Now, the homicide library will be a central storage facility for those records. It'll house files from more than 15,000 cases that will be used by both police investigators and UCLA researchers studying investigation methodology. We hope to go check it out for ourselves soon, and we'll bring you that story as soon as we get it. All right, word association on the radio, so much fun. Okay, when I say Coachella, you say what? Music or festival or combining those two words. Not the wrong answer, it's what most people would say, but the thing is, the music festival is actually in Indio. If you head further east to the city of Coachella, you'll find a lot of a particular fruit. And Coachella grows 90% of what America produces of this tasty fruit. Coming up, why you soon might want to make a date with Coachella. That's ahead in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. To close out today's show, we'd like to talk about one of our favorite subjects, and that's food. There's a close-knit community of farmers and farm workers on the east end of the Coachella Valley who have built up their lives around one crop, dates. Mark Tadros of Aziz Farms is a multi-generational date farmer who has become something of an unofficial California date ambassador. But even he thinks the fruit has an image problem. He joins me in studio to sample some dates and to talk about how he plans to revamp and rebrand dates for the modern age. Mark, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, dates, serious business for you. How did your family start to farm this crop?
So my father immigrated here from Egypt dates were very prominent in Egypt and in the culture. So he has a horticulture background and a horticulture degree. When he came here to the United States, he moved to the Coachella Valley originally to be a tennis pro.
Oh, wow.
And happened to see all of this agriculture and all of the dates in the Coachella Valley. Met some people and started to get involved. That was about 48 years ago.
Tennis pro to date farmer is a big leap. Maybe it's not a big leap, but it's just a leap that maybe people won't think of right away.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a lot of history and lineage in the Middle Eastern culture mm-hmm. that ties dates into California. A lot of our original trees came from Basra, Iraq. It was just some progressive guys that said, you know what, let's bring some of these trees over, plant them in the Coachella Valley, because from a climate perspective, it's very comparable to the deserts and regions that they're grown in the Middle East. And now we have an entire industry in the Coachella Valley that derived from this lineage of the Middle East.
Okay. But you also have your professional trained chef. You've also had marketing experience, Foster Farms. Tell us about some of your background.
So I went to culinary school straight out of high school. I always had a very keen interest in food, mm-hmm. eating it, cooking it, smelling it, tasting it. I was a professional chef for a very long time. And then I got an opportunity to work for Foster Farms Poultry. I was their corporate chef, which gave me a really interesting perspective on manufacturing and marketing and sales on a much grander level. When I saw that my father was starting to get a little bit older, and I looked at it as an opportunity to use some of the things that I learned working in the corporate world and in the culinary world and apply it to what we do as farmers and now as a packing house.
Tell us about the Coachella Valley's history with dates. How unique is the area when it comes to date farming?
We produce 90% of the dates that are consumed in the United States.
90%?
90% of the dates consumed in the United States come out of the Coachella Valley, which is fascinating because when people think of the Coachella Valley, they're not thinking dates, right? They're thinking festivals and modern
music
art and Palm Springs and windmills. And unfortunately, when people come to the Coachella Valley, they're not coming to the east side of the Coachella Valley, where the city of Coachella is, for example, and where our agro community is located. One of the things I tell people is, when you come to Palm Springs and you're seeing date palms, but you're seeing them in their decorative form, right? There's a visceral reaction when people come to an actual working date farm and see a date tree. It is ugly and beautiful at the same time, I guess would be the best way to put it, right? It's not this perfectly manicured tree. It's a tree that actually produces food that people consume.
I'm talking to Mark Tadros of Aziz Farms. All right, so tell us about the Barhi date, how it compares to other dates. That's what you grow.
So we grow a multitude of varietals. Barhi is one of them, and it's one of the things that we specialized in. Barhi is a varietal that can be consumed when it's still crunchy and yellow before it actually cures down on the tree. So it's crunchy like an apple, and it has some interesting tannins to it. I compare them to a really strong Cabernet. So this Barhi date has that in it, in its yellow form, where it has residual sugars and sweetness, but it's crunchy and a little bit tannic. So it's a very interesting flavor combination.
Now, Mark, you don't have the Barhi with you right now, but you have another type of date you want us to try.
Yeah, so I don't have Barhi dates with me currently. They're out of season. We just wrapped up that season about 2 weeks ago. But we just started our medjool harvest for medjool dates. And there's a really fascinating type of medjool that comes off of the trees that's referred to traditionally as rutab.
Rutab.
And rutab has a much higher moisture content because it hasn't completely cured down on the tree. It has higher sweetness. It has it's almost syrupy and caramely. It's definitely an interesting flavor profile, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it to you guys so that you could try it in person.
All right, gimme. That thing looks awesome. Now you said more moisture. What does that do to the flavor, to the taste of it, as opposed to another date?
I find it to be almost like a buttery consistency. It melts in your mouth.
Holy
as opposed to being
smokes.
Chewy. It's really interesting.
Right off the bat, too.
And people laugh at me because sometimes I'll give comparisons on the dates and the flavor profiles like you would in a tasting room for wine.
It almost feels like I grabbed some molasses.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. Grab some molasses and put it in my mouth.
But a healthy molasses. Yeah. I mean, this is as healthy as it gets, too. I mean, it's really good for you and good for your body.
So tell us about those health benefits, because that's one of the things I think that people maybe don't know about dates is how good they are for you.
Yeah, dates are really, really good for you. I mean, they're fuel, right? So you're getting a lot of healthy sugars. It's got a low glycemic index. There's tons of fiber, soluble fiber. Yeah. Antioxidants. So dates are super high in antioxidants.
It's a superfood is what you're talking about.
100%. Yeah. I mean, there is four times the amount of potassium per serving in a date than there is in a banana. The general public, I don't believe, fully understands how good this fruit is for you.
Now, Mark, this wouldn't be the first time someone tried to rebrand a fruit. Here's the campaign some listeners might remember to market the California Raisins as a singing Motown group. I think a lot of people remember that, Mark, but I imagine your vision of dates re-entering the public's conversation won't include dancing, won't include singing, unless you got that in you. Do you have that in you, Mark, to sing and dance a little bit for dates?
You know, I'm not that talented of a singer and dancer.
It's okay. You make a good date, so that's enough. That's enough.
We'll stick to dates for now.
So tell us, what are you doing? What do you have planned to change people's minds about dates?
So one of the things that I've personally taken on my shoulders with my partner, Michelle Tully, who's a high school art teacher, we've taken on throwing a festival November 9th in the city of Coachella. We're bringing people to us. We're bringing people to Ag with this festival, which has been a very important piece to me. So they can come out and experience the East End of the Valley, and they can experience dates at our festival. We signed a very cool headliner. It's the Los Lonely Boys. We have Artie Saquara from the Food Network. She's going to come out and do a cooking demo with dates. We have food vendors. Every food vendor is going to be required to use dates in at least one food menu item. And it's not going to be just 12 guys out there with bacon-wrapped dates. We're going to do some really interesting things so people can understand a little bit better how to utilize dates in cooking as well. I have a championship barbecue team that's coming out do a chicken date sausage.
So you're really pushing hard on this.
You know, when people step off of the plane in the Palm Springs area in the Coachella Valley, they should be thinking about dates the same way they think about pineapples in Hawaii or potatoes in Idaho or oranges in Florida.
That's Mark Todros, state farmer from the Coachella Valley, telling us about his mission to rebrand dates. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, for everyone who's listening in the car, consider this. Are you really a safe driver? Maybe you cruise the speed limit or you're really good about signaling. Well, no matter how safe you think you are, we're pretty sure you've got nothing on Deborah Saray. She's the winner of LA's Safest Driver Competition, the contest set up by USAA Auto Insurance in partnership with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti's office over the summer. So how do they make sure phones stay tucked away and brake lights lit up on time? All the drivers had Big Brother staring right over their shoulders, an app that was monitoring their every single move. And following the rules meant Sarai's daughter had to be ready for school 10 minutes early. And sometimes she ran into trouble with less than by-the-book drivers. It was worth it, though. She won $20,000 and the distinction of being a safe driver in this town, a laudable feat for sure. I should have entered that contest. I consider myself the world's greatest driver. Is that the same as world's safest driver? Bad parker, though. I'm not a good parker. All right, if you missed any part of the show, just go to wherever you get your podcasts, and there Take 2 will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take 2. That's at Take 2 on Twitter. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.